You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
John Banville was last here as Benjamin Black, his crime novel alter ego, but it's been 5 long years since his Booker Prize winning The Sea was published. Critics are already raving about his latest for Knopf, calling The Infinities a magical book, a Beethoven string quartet of a novel which breaks new ground in its own medium. Rather than continuing to quote all of the raves, I prefer just to introduce John Banville and welcome him back to our show. Hi.
I'm glad to be back.
The narrator here is not just anyone, but one of the immortals. Do you want to explain what Zeus, Hermes, and Pan are doing meddling with the godly family?
Yes, Zeus, the father of the gods, has fallen in love very briefly, as the gods do, with Adam Godley's daughter-in-law. Adam Godley is an old man. He's suffered a stroke. He's in a coma, but his mind is still working. And Zeus comes to Earth to spend a night with his daughter-in-law, bringing with him his son and sidekick Hermes. And Hermes is the narrator of most of the book. Mm-hmm. I can hear many of your listeners already being put off, but it's quite light. It's quite lighthearted.
Was it fun to write in the voice of a god? I mean, there have been writers in the past who did it, but they were mostly Greek.
Yes, well,
not
of
Irish.
Course, every novelist thinks that he's a god, or a demigod at least. Yes, it was fun. Looking back on it, I mean, it was hard work as usual. It took the best part of 5 years to write. But it was fun, yes.
At one point, Hermes says, "Why in such times as these would the gods come back to be among men? But the fact is we never left. You only stopped entertaining us."
I think this is true. I suppose as I'm getting older, I'm beginning to look towards heaven more than I used to. It seems to me the world is a very strange place. It has so many unexplained things. And I think the great genius of the Greeks, all that long time ago, thousands of years ago, devised a system to explain the world. There was a god for everything, a god for the wind, a god for fire, a god for the tiniest events, which seems to me a sensible and rational way to do things.
Although they gave the gods human qualities, the gods can be pretty mischievous, or as Hermes adds, we too are petty and vindictive, just like you, when we're put to it.
Well, again, this is the genius of the Greeks, that they didn't make their gods creatures who were untouchably far away and above us or beneath us, that they're amongst us, and they're quite like us, and we're quite like them. They're just as silly and lustful and avaricious as we are.
And Zeus keeps on developing crushes on mortals.
Yes, well, he can't. He just can't keep away from mortal women. Hermes puts forward the notion that really what Zeus wants to do is die, because the immortals envy us our capacity to die, and that he feels that each mortal woman that he comes and falls in love with, that is kind of taking a sip of mortality.
Well, since his wife probably would kill him if she found out what he was doing sometimes, maybe he's actually doing the right kind of thing if he wants to die.
Yes, I think so. I think so, yes. The wife was quite jealous of it.
When I was a kid, almost everyone I knew was familiar with Greek mythology and, to a lesser degree, Norse mythology. Why do you think that's no longer true?
Well, it's not being taught anymore. I mean, the classical languages are no longer taught in schools, and
well, I didn't speak Greek, and when I came upon those little Greek quotations in poetry, I had no idea what was being said. But still, we knew all the stories. We used to read these Greek mythology books. Mm. Everybody I knew.
Yes, I mean, when I was a child, I knew the Greek myths. Now, with this book, younger people complain to me and say, "I don't know who these people are. Who are these gods? What are you talking about?" And I say, "Well, go and look it up, because it'll be good for you." And apart from anything else, the stories are wonderful.
Well, do you think that we're finding our myths in new places, like Harry Potter, or Lord of the Rings, the Matrix movies?
Yes, I think so. I mean, when I was growing up, high culture was still a thing of consequence. It's not anymore. The authority now has moved over to pop culture. You know, the pop singers and the film stars, they're now, and they're the gods. I mean, Hollywood is just like Mount Olympus. You know, the film stars can take the place of the gods.
There are two Adam Godleys here, the elder, who's an esteemed theoretical mathematician, who is dying in a godlike manner in his sky room while the rest of the family gathers below. And the younger Adam Godley is involved in a problematic marriage. I guess it's no accident that the name is Godley.
Yes, I worried a bit about that. Was I being too obvious? But this is a playful book. I meant it to be light and lighthearted. I mean, it's serious, but it's never solemn.
With the C, you started after someone had died. With this, it's on his deathbed when the family gets together and rehashes things.
Yeah, it's a very lively deathbed, isn't it? I mean, he, as far as I can see, and it's not very far because I just wrote the book. I know less about it than you do, I suppose. But as far as I can see, the whole thing's happening in Adam Godley's head.
When you say you know less about it than I do, really? Do you write it that unconsciously?
Well, people constantly tell me things about books that I didn't know. I discover, this is one of the things that's nice to do, one of the reasons it's nice to do readings followed by Q&As, because every time there's a question and answer session, I learn at least two or three things about the book that I didn't know there before. One does write in a kind of dreamlike state. The older I get, the more it seems like a process of dreaming.
A well-known writer once told me that he found himself on an airplane next to someone who taught him in grad school and who had all these theories that had never occurred to the writer himself about what his characters were all about.
Oh, yes. I mean, we work in a trance. I frequently, when I come to read next morning what I wrote the day before, I don't recognize it. I can't remember having written it. And if I were to think at night of sentences that I've written during the day, I wouldn't be able to repeat them.
In this one, you do switch to third person from your usual first person. Is that issuing a challenge to yourself?
I think so, because when I finished The Sea, or just before I finished The Sea, I had started to be Benjamin Black, and I started to write this new kind of fiction. Mystery stories, relatively simple. And they were in the third person. And I think in a peculiar way, without my realizing it, that was a preparation for making the switch to third person in this book.
Your first sentences are often remarked on. Could you read the beginning of the book?
Yeah, I'll read the first paragraph. Of the things we fashioned for them that they might be comforted, dawn is the one that works. When darkness sifts from the air like fine soft soot and light spreads slowly out of the east, then all but the most wretched of humankind rally. It is a spectacle we immortals enjoy, this minor daily resurrection. Often we will gather at the ramparts of the clouds and gaze down upon them, our little ones, as they bestir themselves to welcome the new day. What a silence falls upon us then, the sad silence of our envy. Many of them sleep on, of course, careless of our cousin Aurora's charming matutinal trick. But they're always the insomniacs, the restless ill, the lovelorn tossing on their solitary beds, or just the early risers, the busy ones with their knee bends and their cold showers and their fussy little cups of black ambrosia. Yes, all who witness it greet the dawn with joy, more or less, except, of course, the condemned man, for whom first light will be the last on earth.
Is that how you started the book?
Yes, I write from the first line to the last line.
Really?
I can't get ahead of myself. I can't plunge into a future chapter. Even if I know what's going to be in it, I can't do it.
And you don't go back and rework it after the book has been developing?
I used to, when I started writing, I would write many versions of a book. My first novel, there are at least 9 versions. And somebody recently who was dealing with my papers told me there are 22 versions of The Sea. But the changes that I would make when I finish the book are relatively small. What I do is I get the sentence right before I leave it and move on to the next one.
You have mentioned in an interview that you try to give your prose the kind of denseness and thickness that poetry has, because language is as important to you as coming up with a good plot?
Yes, I mean, a lot of fiction is about things, but I like my fiction to be the thing itself. that you can't separate the content from the method of narration. The language is as important as what it's saying.
Do you think that being an Irish writer in English, English, of course, is the first language in Ireland, but still, Irish writers seem to have a different take on English. Do you think that's affected the way you approach this?
Yeah, English doesn't feel to us like our first language. Even though it's our mother tongue, it doesn't seem to be our first language. We are not at home in it. We're not at ease in English. This is very good for writers because it allows us to stand outside and allows us to play with the language. Yes, I mean, the influence of the Irish language is still very deeply ingrained in us.
I'm thinking about someone like Joyce, who just loved playing with the language, or Beckett, who wrote in French.
Yes, Beckett wrote in French. He said, pour écrire sans style, to write without style. I don't quite believe it, but it is dangerous. Our love of language, our delight in playing with language is a danger. We can be self-indulgent.
You say at one point that the Irish language is very oblique. It's one of avoidance.
Yes, it's a much more poetic language than the basic English that we were given in the 19th century. I mean, we changed from Irish, the Irish language, to English in the space of about a decade. It's an extraordinary phenomenon. Never happened anywhere else. Nobody quite knows why or how we did it.
And a few people are speaking Irish. Is it Erse?
No, Irish. We call it Irish.
But it's there in the back of people's heads?
Yes. I mean, it's... I can feel it, even though I suppose my great-grandparents probably would have switched from Irish to English. So that's a long time ago, but I still feel the influence of the Irish language.
When you won the Booker Prize for The Sea, it stood up quite a storm. One critic fumed that it was possibly the worst, certainly the most perverse, and perhaps most indefensible choice in the 36-year history of the contest. Now, obviously, it is not. But what upset him so much?
It's a great thing about the Booker Prize. It always causes a row. This is one of the reasons that it stays in the news, and I'm glad that it should. When I saw that piece, it appeared the morning after the Booker Prize, a great satisfied smile spread across my face. I thought I must be doing something right if I'm annoying the book reviewers.
Probably helps sell a few books.
Oh, probably, yes, of course.
So do you have any idea what it was? Just simply that he had his own favorite and it wasn't your book?
The London literary world is very small and very complicated, and I don't really understand it, and I don't particularly want to.
Do you think it bothers him that you never went to university?
It possibly does. I don't know. There is a lot of snobbery, I suppose, in England. Yes.
Had you always wanted to write, despite that?
Oh, yes. I mean, I've been writing since I was 12 or so. This is one of the main reasons I didn't go to university, is that I was too impatient.
Uh-huh. But you did work as a copy editor and then as the chief literary critic for the Irish Times. Were you already writing your own fiction at that point?
Oh, yes. I mean, I published my first book in the same year that I started working in the newspapers. And I worked in the newspapers for many years, many decades. It was a good way to earn a living. I worked at night because I was working on daily papers. And that gave me the daylight hours to write in.
How did you work out the plot for this book, the interweaving of the gods with the godlies?
Well, it takes its inspiration from a very great play by the German dramatist Heinrich von Kleist called Amphitryon. Kleist is very little known in the English-speaking world, which is a great shame because he's a very, very great writer.
Broken
indeed.
Jug or something?
The Broken Jug, Amphitryon, Penthesilea. Amphitryon, I think, is his masterpiece, which is about Zeus coming to Earth because he's fallen in love with the wife of a Theban general and so on. And I was going to base the novel much more closely on that play, but, of course, fiction has its own rules and its own needs, and it drifted away. But the skeleton of the play is still there inside the book.
You've chosen a wide variety of subject matters to inspire your novels. Copernicus, the deconstructivist Paul de Man, who was a Nazi collaborator in his early years. The British art connoisseur Anthony Blunt, who turned out to also be a Soviet spy. Do you like using real events as a jumping-off place for your fiction?
Yes, I suppose so. I mean, I wrote the Copernicus book because I had written a book called Birchwood, which was sort of my Irish book, and I thought I don't want to keep on writing Irish books for the rest of my life.
Even though you continue to live in Ireland.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm an internal exile, you know.
Internal.
Internal. Instead of leaving, I'm in exile in Ireland, which is a good place to be as well. Good situation to be in.
Well, hasn't Ireland changed a lot for intellectuals? There was a time when everybody complained that it was repressive, and some people, even like Edna O'Brien, were forced to leave.
Oh, yes. I mean, it was appalling for people like Edna and my friend, the late John McGahan.
And, of course, James Joyce earlier.
Well, Joyce was never driven out. Joyce just went of his own accord, and so did Beckett. But certainly the censorship of writers in the from the 1920s up to the 1980s was absolutely appalling. I mean, completely harmless little short stories by people like Frank O'Connor and Sean would be banned, you know. Terrible.
So how do you wind up in an internal exile now?
Well, you know, the when you're an Irish writer, you're supposed to go into exile. No Irish writer ever emigrated. They all went into exile, shaking their fist from the back of the ship as they sailed away. I like living in Ireland. It suits me. I like the climate. I like the light. There's something there that I need. But I don't feel that I'm... how would I say? I don't feel that I'm absolutely Irish. I prefer to think that I'm European, at least.
Well, in this case, you have drawn from Van Kleist and written about the Greek gods, not the former curator of the Queen's art collection. In the end, is it the same because you're still going to some other source as your initial inspiration?
Oh, yes. I mean, the imagination remakes reality. By the time I finish a book, if it's based on a real person, such as Copernicus or Anthony Blunt, I've forgotten that they were real people. It's been transmuted into fiction.
You've said that you don't regard the novel as a very interesting art form, and yet you write novels.
Well, I can't do anything else. It is a sort of clumsy form. I'm very fond of it in a way, but I don't find it intellectually interesting. There's a distinction there. I suppose I'd rather be a poet. If I had my wish, I'd be a composer. I mean, this is what I'd really like to be. But I'm stuck with the novel. And there is a charmingly vulgar side to writing. You know, there's that simple childish desire that we all have to be told stories or to tell stories, and that is very much part of the novel still.
I'm assuming you're working on another one.
Yes. Or, you know, if I stopped working, I'd fall off the edge.
Really, just go from one to the other? Do you have a list of things you want to write about, or is it just you finish one and another thing occurs to you?
I think I get into a mild state of panic as I come to the close of a book, and I have to have a new one on the go before I finish. Otherwise, I might break down.
Are you ever affected by the reviews? It could be a very positive review.
I don't read.
John Banville should be doing more of this kind of thing.
I don't read reviews anymore.
You really don't?
No. It's a wonderful sense of lightness. You know, you feel as if you're in a hot air balloon. You just drift away on publication day. But then you can always depend on your friends to tell you about the really bad ones.
Well, I'm here to tell you that this book has gotten great reviews.
Good.
The Infinities is John Banville's latest. He's the winner of the Man Booker Prize for The Sea, which was published about 5 years ago. And this one is published by Knopf. I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.